has a practice with his students that after he gives a talk, one of the students gets up and summarizes the talk. And I think it's a great practice because you have to listen very carefully to kind of be able to summarize and put in your own words at the end. And I thought it was a great practice. But we're not going to do that here. We have a tape recorder. So it's two kinds of self-importance. And the subject of self-importance has been on my mind because of this personal issue that came up at meetings I've been to recently. And as I mentioned some time ago, I'm on this, what's called the Ethics Committee for the San Francisco Zen Center. And the Ethics Committee is charged of coming up with a document of the ethical principles of the Zen Center. And it's very slow to come up with, to get everybody to agree on ethical principles, especially Zen people. And also it is, sometimes it's a difficult process, and sometimes you think that there should be an ethics document for how an ethics committee should talk about ethics. But what happened is that I'm the main person who's crafting the document. It's mostly I've written it. And now what I'm doing, there's a committee of four of us who are going over the document that I originally wrote and changing it, editing it, adding things, taking out things. And we seldom refer to it anymore as my document. I wrote it. We say it's the working document or something. That, yeah, I don't really want to identify so strongly with it. It's the committee's document. However, as we're revising the document, I write new pieces. So a few weeks ago, I wrote a new section. And I gave it to one other person on the committee. Not to the whole committee, just one other person for him to look at. And he took what I'd written and rewrote it slightly. And his rewrite, he then submitted to the whole committee for review. And so we were working on that and seeing if we could kind of make it work for us. But the only person who knew that basically it came from what I wrote was him and me. And the other two people didn't know that I had written this piece. So then I could see in my mind, this thought arises, that I want credit. I want everybody to know that I had written this. And there is my dilemma, or there is my issue that was very, very alive for me, was to explore what's going on here with wanting to assert myself and get credit for this piece. And on the one hand, getting recognition, having recognition, is very important. And there are times when it's very healthy to assert oneself, and so people know who we are, what our strengths are, and what our capabilities are, and to be sure that we get heard. And it's a healthy movement to do so. And sometimes people who get the message that self-effacement is where it's at hold back from asserting themselves at times when necessary to assert themselves. So that's on one hand. And on the other hand, self-assertion or the desire for getting credit or recognition can be motivated by the need for self-aggrandizement, for propping up one's artifice of self-image or self-imagining. It can serve the purpose which can counter or cover up, I believe, the deepest wellsprings of our honesty and our integrity. And so this is what I had to sort out. What was my motivation for wanting to speak up and get credit? And in my own case, I recognized that it was mostly from very old reflexes of concerns about self-importance, of self-assertion, that came from protecting a kind of self-image, from feeling kind of inadequate or feeling unworthy, and wanting to kind of prove that I was worthy or adequate and having people recognize that. And, well, maybe that's just to say that now. When I first started my meditation practice, some long ago, over 20 years ago, One of the early surprises I had was to see, begin to see, how much I operated on self-image, or what the Buddhist tradition probably calls conceit. That I was constantly concerned about finally evaluating myself and judging myself whether I was good enough or bad enough, or how was I in comparison to someone else, and trying to come up with schemes and strategies to get other people to see me in certain ways and think of me in certain ways, and the ways I talked, probably the ways I walked and gestured, and everything was part of the strategy. And it was kind of amazing to start, when you slow down and quiet down enough to begin to see how the mind works, sometimes it's a real shock to see how incessant it can be. So I saw a lot of what the Buddhist tradition calls conceit. And it's this is a footnote. It's interesting that where Buddhism puts emphasis on the topic or the theme of conceit, I believe, I know very little about it, but I believe in Christianity, the parallel kind of concern is pride. And I just think it's interesting. I don't know what the difference is between conceit and pride, and why two different religious traditions point fingers in two different directions. Maybe one reason is that maybe conceit is a wider concept than pride. Because as I'm fond of saying, the Buddhist tradition says there's three kinds of conceit. There's the conceit of thinking you're better than someone, which is maybe pride. There's the conceit of thinking you're inferior to someone, and the conceit that you're equal to someone. All four of conceit. Any neurotic is living a life which in some respects is extreme in its self-centeredness. The region of his or her misery represents a complete preoccupation with oneself. The very nature of the neurotic disorder is tied to pride. If the sufferer is hypersensitive, resentful, capricious, he or she may be indicating a fear that one will not appear to advantage in competitive situations where one wants to show one's worth. If one is chronically indecisive, one is showing fear that one may do the wrong thing and be discredited. If one is over-scrupulous and self-critical, one may be endeavoring to show how praiseworthy one really is. Thus, most neuroses are, from the point of view of religion, mixed with the sin of pride. And maybe Buddhism would say it's mostly mixed with the neurosis, because Buddhism doesn't have sin, mixed with conceit. And conceit, as I understand it, is comparing oneself to others along ideas of better than, worse than, equal to, worthy, unworthy, good, bad, the same, adequate, inadequate, all the ways in which we can compare ourselves according to some kind of value. And so conceit is comparing oneself according to some value judgment. There's a lot of comparing and contrasting that can be done without a value judgment. Maybe one example is you can compare people's noses. And some people you can notice have small noses, and some people have big noses, and the rest of us have normal noses. And you can make those comparisons. A value judgment would be that those people with big noses are better people. Those people with big noses are more worthy or more adequate or something. That's a value judgment that's adding to the basic kind of fact that you see. And what happens is we don't notice sometimes the difference between factual comparisons and value comparisons. And then we often identify most strongly with the value comparisons as if they're really real. So, you know, who cares what size your nose is? You know, but we get all worked up about, you know, big noses are better, or small noses are better, or whatever. Where we tend to identify with, I propose, is not with big noses, small noses, but is with the value we put on such things. We identify with a value judgment. And of course, noses are just a metaphor for everything that we tend to do the same thing with. For example, a person may be fat or maybe skinny, and that's just a basic issue. And people don't identify or don't get worked up or anxious about the simple fact They get anxious because of a value judgment, an opinion and view about what that means for themselves. And where the identification comes in, or the projection or the problem, is not with the basic fact, but in the realm of the value that we put on the basic fact. And the identification is a kind of clinging, holding on to, or believing very strongly in the value judgment that we have. And identification is very powerful in life. And one of the problems with identification is that it strengthens the notion of conceit. The stronger we identify, the stronger the conceit becomes. And this maybe doesn't quite follow, but I like it. It's from this wonderful book called The Peace Pilgrim. And the woman there, the author, she says, "Judging others will avail you nothing and injure you spiritually. Only if you can inspire others to judge themselves will anything worthwhile have been accomplished." That was nice. If you can inspire others to judge themselves. One of the great lessons I had in how I judge other people was when I was 18, I went to Morocco. And it was the first non-Western country I went to as an adult by myself. And I noticed how at ease and kind of fresh and light my mind was as I walked around the streets. And at some point I realized the reason why I was so light and fresh was that the people back then, they were wearing all these kind of traditional clothes. Men wearing the robes, the yalabas, I think they're called. And it was the people who were so different from my own culture that all the categories by which I judged people didn't apply. So instead of going down the road and saying, oh, that person's a conservative, that person's a jock, that person's a fox, that person's a whatever we might, you know, do, you know, or that person, you know, is too much this, or that person's too much that, or, you know, I couldn't do it because it didn't compute, this new culture. And I realized what a relief it was. As mindfulness becomes stronger, as we practice gets stronger, and our mindfulness both in our sitting practice and mindfulness practice in daily life becomes stronger, there's a tendency to become increasingly aware not only of our thoughts and how our thoughts work, but also the strong tendency to cling to or to identify with or to be preoccupied with certain kinds of thoughts. We tend to be preoccupied or identified with things like judgments, views, opinions, thoughts of self-righteousness, aversion, need for status, position, power, need for approval, opinions of a relative worth or lack of worth, and it probably the list goes on, but of kind of certain things would really tend to grab us. And of course, we're often helped by our society, which collectively often assigns value to an individual based on the person's sex, gender, color, nationality, or whatever. And so to the degree in which society do it, sometimes we internalize it or we're aided in our own tendencies to do it. So as mindfulness becomes stronger, we become aware of the subtle, both the subtle and sometimes gross strategies we have for propping up or reinforcing or acting out these kinds of judgments that we identify with, these kind of values that we identify with. And when I first started doing, within the first year or two of doing a lot of meditation practice, when I started to become shocked, become surprised at the revelation of how much my mind was kind of spinning out strategies and preoccupied with self-assertion and self-worth and proving myself and being someone special, and I saw that there was a possibility of not living that way, and that seeing that possibility actually frightened me. And there was a period of time where I was afraid of letting down my defenses, letting down my preoccupation, because I didn't know what would happen. There's a reason why they're up. They kind of protect their vulnerability. And I didn't know what would happen if I let them down. One of the things I saw was that my friends around me that I had at that time helped support me in playing out my trips. I had all these trips that I played out. And my friends, some of them had the same trips and some of them kind of whatever, we kind of reinforced the same ideas. And then thinking about this today, I thought about how things like self-righteousness, that shared self-righteousness is often invisible. Many things, many trips that people have, when people share them, two people share them, they tend to become invisible in the dynamics of those two people. And today I was just thinking about self-righteousness. If two people are self-righteous, because I was in college and I was realizing this, I was kind of self-righteous around various things. And some of my friends were also. And if we're both self-righteous, we talk about them in the kind of self-righteous way, we can't see it. Then I noticed that when I went to visit the San Francisco Zen Center, that if I was playing off my trips, if I was being self-righteous or whatever, that people there didn't pick up the ball and run. They didn't participate. I felt people like were mirrors to me. And I thought this was really great. It was kind of painful. But I wanted to be around those people rather than the people who kind of invisibly supported me in my old trips. So I moved to the San Francisco Zen Center. And it was great. It really worked wonderful for me to have that mirror. And after being there for a long time, I realized it wasn't so much these people were necessarily all wise. Some of them were. But some of them were just aloof. But I valued a lot that experience, and some of them were wise. So I went to the Zen Center to live in a Buddhist community for these two reasons. One was to have people mirror me instead of participate in my own trips. And the other was to deepen my meditation practice, to have a chance to deepen my practice. And I had a very strong sense at that time that through intensifying my meditation practice, I could become clearer and clearer about what I was doing in my daily life. That there was a very direct correlation to the depth of my clarity of meditation and how well I could integrate or apply the mindfulness practice to my daily life. And a lot of people, one of the gratifying things for me as a teacher is when people ask questions about how they can apply the meditation practice to their daily life. And applying it is a little bit different than asking the question of how you can integrate the practice in daily life. And how I'm thinking about how they're different is the question of how to integrate, for me, and you might have a different idea what this word means, is how to integrate some of the things that happen in our sitting practice into our daily life. Some of the insights, the understandings, the abilities to be mindful. And it occurs to me also that some people who talk about integrating their practice into their life don't really have anything yet to integrate. You have to have done some serious meditation practice to really have something from your meditation time to be able to integrate into your daily life. And it really helps a lot to have a certain... And I've got three ways in which strong meditation practice can really help us apply and wake up in our daily life. One is that a strong meditation practice, it strengthens our mindfulness. By doing mindfulness diligently and continuously in meditation practice, that muscle becomes stronger. But it's not only mindfulness to get stronger, but it's also other qualities that are important for spiritual life. And one that I can mention now is self-acceptance. That in sitting practice, it's possible, I believe, to come to some radical forms of self-acceptance that make it a lot easier to practice than in daily life. So in my situation, I was frightened of giving up my trips. I was frightened what would happen. But I found a level of trust in myself in my meditation practice that I began daring to take the risk of letting go and being a different way in everyday life. Another way in which this sitting practice can help is that often with certain amount of sitting, meditation practice, the mind becomes calm and stable. And when the mind becomes calm and stable, it's a lot easier to see clearly what is going on in the mind and the heart. And the more clearly you can see what's going on in the mind and the heart, the more clearly you can be responsive and wake up to the situation. Take it into account. Become free. And then another, which is somewhat related to these first two, is that at some point, as mindfulness meditation deepens, you realize that you can't control it, that what you're experiencing is outside of your control, and that it's okay, that it's okay to be part of a process in which you're not in the controls of anymore. And that experience of not being in control and feeling that it's okay can help us a lot to risk being maybe not so much in control, to be more vulnerable in our everyday life. So sometimes I felt afraid of giving up what I felt I had to give up. And I remember sometimes it felt like, you know, this experience you have, you're standing on the edge of a pool of cold, you know, cold pool, and you're supposed to jump in, and you're kind of standing there. And I felt for months and months, I'm standing there, kind of, I knew I needed to jump in into this more vulnerable space. But, you know, how long have I, you know, sometimes I've walked away from pool edges. So after 20 years later, after going to the Zen Center to get some good mirrors of who I was, I found myself on this ethics committee for the Zen Center. And my self-importance still came up. It came up very differently than it used to. It doesn't seem to be such a big issue anymore, but it floats through still. And I mentioned this to someone last week, this experience of being there and wanting to speak up at the meeting about, hey, you know, wait a minute, I wrote this. You know, I want credit. I wouldn't have said it that grossly. It would have been more subtle. And I probably could have said it so subtly that, you know, they wouldn't have even noticed that I was slipping in this information. But, you know, I didn't speak up. And I didn't say it. Rather, I stayed with the kind of strong motivation and uneasiness that was around that issue. I stayed with that, and it was kind of painful. I could feel a certain kind of clinging and rushing energy in my brain, in my mind. And so someone asked me, well, why didn't you just kind of say it anyway? If you just said it, you know, and got the credit and got out of the way, you would have been relieved, and you wouldn't have had an issue anymore, and you wouldn't have to carry with you this level of suffering, of this dilemma, this, you know, and, you know, be done with it. And in some ways, that kind of short-term gratification would have been, maybe, could be very tempting. There's, however, I think in the long term, if you have understanding of what the consequences are of actions, you would have realized in the long term that wouldn't have served me very well, wouldn't serve us very well. That if I had acted on it right away, just to relieve the tension or the pressure, or to convince the people there that I was special, in my notes I have a little bit differently. By not giving in to that motivation, I could think of 5 things that I accomplished or that resulted. One is, by not giving in, I was able to stay in the midst of that dynamic, the dynamics of what was going on, and explore it and get to know it better. I was able to study it and find out. If I had acted on it and released the energy right away, I couldn't have explored and understood it, the deeper dynamics of why I was wanting to do that, what was going on. And if I had given into it, I would have reinforced the habit of doing that, and it would have made it easier probably next time to do it. And I think you can never get enough approval or recognition if you have a judgment or view of yourself that you're inadequate. If you're trying to fill a kind of sense of inadequacy, you'll never get enough. And if you never get enough, it becomes, you can, maybe you want more and more, and so it constantly becomes a habit, and you sort of stop noticing even you're doing it after a while. 3. This thing was important. If I had acted on it and spoken up, unless I was very subtle about it perhaps, I would have interrupted the meeting. The process, the way the meeting was kind of unfolding and moving through time, the kind of discussion that was happening. It had nothing to do with this discussion and what we were talking about, to have me get credit. So I would have interrupted the meeting. And not only that, I would have created a kind of divisiveness in our meeting, especially in this meeting of this committee, because we were a committee with our intention being that we write the document together, even though I was the one who was writing most of it. It was a committee project, it was a cooperative project. If I had asserted my need for credit, I believe it would have kind of taken put a crack in the cooperative efforts. That it's a cooperative effort, a cooperatively written document, with no one individually gets credit. And certainly, you know, I didn't need any more recognition anyway. Everybody knew I'd written most of the document. So why did I need to get need credit for every single sentence in the document? So it wouldn't have served anything in the meeting. It would have just been an interruption for where the discussion was going. Another thing that happened was, by restraining myself from acting on it, I became energized. And part of that energy went into studying myself, and part of the energy went into being more fully there, present and alive for the meeting. I was really, you know, on my edge. And I was much more present for the meeting. If I just given into it, I suspect in some way that would have been an energy drain for myself. Maybe not, I don't know. And then last, by not giving into it, by resisting the effort to kind of speak up and get credit, I had the opportunity to accept my humanness. And maybe that's the most profound part of it all. Just, oh, I'm a human being after all. And just accept that rather than fight it or judge it or say I'm terrible because of that. And perhaps even by restraining from acting on it, kind of feeling it really fully, I gave myself an opportunity to be amused with myself. Amused with myself. To smile. There it is again. After 20 years. And this time I didn't need them as a mirror. I could do it myself. Isn't that a great improvement? So, and I'll just end my part with a couple of, maybe they're just stray things, but one of the precepts that they have in the Zen tradition, one of the 10 precepts, is the precept not to praise self at the expense of others. I think that's very interesting, the way they word it. Not to praise self at the expense of others. It doesn't say don't praise yourself. Just don't do it expensively. Don't say it. Do it in such a way that you create divisiveness, or you put other people down, or you know you make them inferior to you, or whatever. Don't praise self at the expense of others. And one of the things about language and speech and precepts is that they are studies. They are helps to show us how not to create divisions among people, to divide people up. To help us prevent divisions, and to help us at the same time bring people together and create more concord and harmony among a community. So I thought I would read from this famous document that the Ethics Committee wrote. It's becoming such a long document, I don't know if it's going to be useful for anybody. So this is not about the precept. I wanted to do something about... this is not about praising self at the expense of others. It's about another precept, which is a disciple of the Buddha does not slander others. But what's said here about slander could apply to praising self at the expense of others. So a disciple of the Buddha does not slander others. This precept arises from the Bodhisattva's efforts to build social concord and understanding. Slandering in and of itself is an act of alienation from oneself and from others. The consequence of slander is often pain for others and divisiveness in the community. Where the intention to slander arises, the effort to understand its roots is an expression of not slandering. What I liked especially was slandering in and of itself is an act of alienation from oneself and from others. And I think also the same thing about praising self at the expense of others is a kind of is an act of alienation from one deepest self and from others around you.
What is exactly slander?
Slander is to put other people down, to say things about other people that is demeaning or malicious, often behind their back. I think that's my idea. Is that about right?
I thought it was also untrue.
Slander is also untrue?
Mm-hmm. Well,
or
exaggerated. So do you agree that there's two kinds of self-importance? Self-importance that is the core of everything good in us, and another kind is the core of everything rotten?
Yeah?
Yeah? Uh-huh. And how do you distinguish the two?
Because when the self-importance that has to do with what I like to call pride as opposed to vanity, that there's the self that says you want to live up to ideals of right speech, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very similar situation to yours, I kept my mouth shut in the small group because I was embarrassed that other people should know that I wanted recognition so badly that I would interrupt everything. I didn't want to confess to that. And I also realized that it would be embarrassing for the woman who hadn't given me credit, because she so clearly hadn't, that it would have been embarrassing for her. And decided to really keep my mouth shut. And what happened after that was, I began to look at her very differently than I had, that she should feel so insecure that she had to take credit for it. And where was she coming from? So, I don't know, I felt more kindly towards her after that. She's coming from some very difficult spot, that she should have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't this have been just an innocent oversight? Why are you, my house, I had made a presentation and you think not.
Could easily have been.
Do you have any obligation to the person who apparently took credit for something you did? Something going on with him.
Oh.
Do you have any obligation to try to help him because he's obviously with his vanity and insecurity and stuff?
In my situation, the committee, the person who had presented the rewrite of my document, there was no issue for him. There was no issue on his part about. Taking credit away from me. He wasn't trying to get credit for himself either. It was completely, for him, it was a completely cooperative event. He was working with a document that we had and had rewritten it a little bit. And he certainly wasn't getting credit. As a matter of fact, at the last meeting we went to, he mentioned, just kind of in passing, that I had written it. Yes, Rainbow.
I was thinking about the next obvious place from there is to feel pride that you didn't. speaking to where I
yeah, yeah.
Going.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it doesn't end. I almost brought the poem by Kabir, but I've read it so many times that I didn't want to do it again. About you remember the poem? He says, I cut back my sexual longings, and I noticed I was angry all the time. I cut back my anger, and I noticed that I was proud all the time. It just goes on and on.
Really, just goes on and on.
I think if you don't understand the sources of it, it does. Yeah.
But you know, that does raise the question too, though, that that what you can take joy in is, you know, the fact that, oh, you know, I made a choice and I did this instead of that, and to recognize that, you know, there is stuff you can be proud of, frankly, so. The things that you feel good about yourself, and it's the other side of the coin, you know, that you were talking about. There's two sides, just like to everything, and I maybe like intention behind it all.
Very good point. And I felt that by not speaking up, I was coming more from some deeper sense of integrity that I had, and I was happy about that. And I don't. And maybe you could say I wouldn't say I was proud of it. It's interesting. This is a footnote, but it's interesting that it's something called semantic shift in the word pride over the centuries. It used to be a horrible sin in Western culture, and lately it's become shifted. Now it's really a good thing. We talk about people's pride, and it's really good. I think it's fine to have it. The word shift meaning shift, and I think it really serves an important function now. But the Buddhist thing is, since Buddhists don't talk about pride in any form, I think, at least traditionally. But what the Buddhists would do would they talk about rejoicing in one's virtue and good qualities. And so, rather than feeling pride in your good qualities, you rejoice in them, and that's considered to be a very wholesome thing to do, and has a lot of integrity. And it's often suggested you spend time rejoicing in your good qualities, your good deeds. And things like that.
Knowing that you had initially authored this document and seeing somebody else take it a step further, wouldn't that in itself have given you enough inner satisfaction to tell yourself, wow, I've done this, and look what's happening to me?
You think so, wouldn't you? Yeah, for sure.
I found that this doesn't always work. Not taking credit doesn't always work for me in the office. Because while I'm content very often to do something and then let go of it, if I don't get credit, my boss wonders, well, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And I have to then present a list. So I have to in some way let people know this came from me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think as I said at the beginning, there are times when I think it's very important and healthy to assert oneself and to get credit and in certain work situations where it's essential, your motivation to do it is not from some place of lack of integrity or inadequacy, but it can just be done out of survival or really necessary. And my wife works with a woman who refuses to take absolutely any credit for anything and is constantly deferring to everybody else, and it's just really painful to be around her. She says, stand up for yourself a little bit. And certainly there's a place for it too, to get credit. And I think it's healthy to get some, to get recognition and feel happy with what you did and feel happy that other people recognize and feel other people's, be able to receive other people's praise. And I think that's a very important thing, to be able to receive that. It helps us. But it all depends on the motivation behind it. Yeah?
This is a semantic point, I suppose, and it may be the fact that I have a somewhat conservative upbringing, at least in terms of the language is concerned, but I feel much more comfortable with the term self-esteem. And self-pride always is a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
And any value I have in myself is esteemed, and tends to be a neutral thing rather than something that's either pushing out. And my experience personally with myself and with what I can see of the way other people operate. Is that people who have low self-esteem are the people who are always doing the things that taking credit for things, making sure that they get credit for the things that they've done because they feel insecure. And the times that I do that, I know I felt insecure in myself in the situation. And so I make sure that everything that I've done is chalked up on the positive side, where and the reason I'm doing that is, it's obvious to me that the reason I'm doing that is that I really don't feel comfortable with myself in the situation.
So it's interesting the range of meanings behind the word pride, and different people have different references for the word. And then this thing that people have, it's interesting also that people in Buddhist psychology, people who have low sense of self-worth can still have very strong conceit. People who are very shy, we say often in the West, that person has very low sense of self-worth. But there can be a very, very strong conceit, because to be very shy, you have to be making a very strong comparison about yourself and judgment about yourself in relationship to others. It might be a judgment that pulls you back, but still there's a very strong sense of self there. And so we Buddhists would call that conceit also. So, the last question and the last comment.
Would you say that conceit then is involved in, always involved in judging what other people are going to think about?
No, I don't think that can be part of it, but I think it has a lot to do with judgments you make about yourself. You judge that, for example, you might think, if someone thinks of me in a certain way, then you make a judgment, that's bad for me, or I don't want that, or I don't want to be seen that way. So I would say conceit has to do with judgments that we make about the situation. Anyway, I spent a week thinking about this a little bit, and it felt really rich for me to explore this whole area, and I think it's valuable in mindfulness practice to start noticing how our mind strategies and works, and then spend time hanging out with it, trying to understand it better. So I'll see some of you on Sunday, and I look forward to our hike together. Thank you.